Well, we had quite an amazing thing happen in Red Bluff a couple days ago. We had snow show up, you know. Now, some of you may be acquainted with that, but it was just amazing. I was out in the morning. We didn't have electricity. Just enjoying in awe of the 2 inches of snow, which turned out to be about 5 inches of snow where I live. But as I was standing outside, I just was hearing these crashes of branches falling down all around me, and I actually saw a big branch crash down out of my neighbor's tree. So quite an event. But one of the highlights of that whole thing for me was that my son, my adult son Wesley, came over and we built a couple snowmen. So that's probably the first time a snowman's been built in my yard in probably a few millennia. I don't know. So anyway, I hope you guys survived. We were without power for a number of hours. It took me a good bit of work and grace of God to get my generator going, but we did get that going. But some of you, how many of you lost power? How many of you are still out without power? I can tell by the look of your hair. It sounds like most people fared pretty well in that regard. A good part of Red Bluff was without power, so we got it back last evening. But praise God for his grace. If you are coming in and you're cold and shivering, or you're weary and tired, I pray that God's presence and goodness will be felt even in the midst of that for you this morning. So I do want to, before we get started, take a minute to pray for us and ask God to just come and help us and bless us with his presence. So, Father, I thank you that we have been given life and breath again this morning, and you have brought us to this place. And we are here, God, because of you, and because we want more of you. We want your goodness and your power and your blessing to be poured into our lives and through our lives into the lives of others. And God, we don't want to fabricate this. We can't make this up. And so we just ask that you would come and graciously enliven our hearts to you, to your reality as the living God, as the one who draws near to your people. Will you help us to take those risks of faith that are needed to draw near to you? Would we not be as those who shrink back in doubt, but come to you with expectation that you are a good father who has good gifts for your children? So work among us in this hour we have together, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. Well, let me just kind of line out the territory for what I'm hoping to do together with you this morning. First, I want to just highlight some of the main points from last week with you, and then we're going to explore personality trait preferences and then look at how that relates to God, so hang on for that. And then I want to identify some major aspects of what I'm referring to as God's foremost delight in his Son. So we'll take some time to look at that. And then finally, I want to close up again by just trying to build a bridge and bring into focus implications for us in our lives regarding God's foremost delight in his Son. So that's what I'm hoping to accomplish with you this morning. So let's just begin with a quick review of what we did last week. I'm not going to go into all of it, cover all the notes. You can grab those in the back if you want. But we started by kind of looking at our spiritual disposition. We kind of put a spectrum on the board from, man, I just have no desire, no motivation to pursue the things of God, to, this is the best time of my life, things are great. And then there's some middlers in there. I'm one of those middlers, kind of can move between 2 and 4, And so we looked at that a little bit. I invited you to kind of see where are you at, you know, now. Obviously, we change in different times and seasons, but we spent some time just kind of trying to put ourselves on the map. And then we looked at a few of many psalms that we could have put in front of us that speak to the fact that in the presence of God, there are good things. There are pleasures forevermore, and there are things that will delight us, and so we use that then as an opportunity to really look at an introduction to the class, and so the core of this class is built on the premise that as we understand what God takes delight in, and share in those same pleasures that God has delight in, then our joy in God and the things that He delights in will be increased. So this class is really about increasing my capacity and your capacity to enjoy God by seeing more clearly and internalizing more fully the things that God takes delight in. So that's what we're going to be pressing into. So after we spent some time, so we said, okay, well, what are the questions you have? What would be a positive outcome for you? What do you like least excited about in this class? And then you know, what are some genuine questions that you have? The takeaway from that was, man, I'd really love it if in outcomes classes I'm experiencing at least more regularly or in new ways the presence of God and a satisfaction and delight in God, but I'm a little fearful that if I get my expectations too high, God's not going to come through and I'll be disappointed. And so just as an aside, let me say, God is big enough to shoulder the possibility that you might be disappointed. So don't be concerned that you're going to disappoint God, that you come away disappointed. And secondly, I want to say that I believe that part of the way God works is we have to step forward and take risks from our perspective in our pursuit of God, risks that I won't get what I was hoping for, risks that somehow my struggles and difficulties won't be lifted. I won't get this piece of God that I'm really hoping to get. I think that God is pleased with and delights to meet people who, from that position of, I don't know if this is going to turn out the way I want to, takes risks, takes steps toward God and say, God, I can't make this happen. I need you to show up. I think God is pleased to step into the spheres of people's lives who are moving in that direction, who are saying, I'm willing to risk it, God. You're worth the risk of me stepping forward and maybe being disappointed. And ultimately, I can promise you, in God's timing and in God's way, He will prove to not be a disappointment. The end of the story is, you will be caught up and captivated by the goodness of God and delight in Him in ways that we can't even imagine. But we live in the here and now, right? So you come into this room and I come to this room with struggles and disappointments. And so we're just praying that God would show up. So we spent a little bit of time on that. And then we composed a bullet point resume for God. Remember that? So we just kind of did a thought experiment. If God was applying for the role of chief executive of global operations, what could we put on His resume? And so we looked at a number of verses and we came up with some things, you know, like, well, He controls the weather and He's has strong creative ability and He's able to be everywhere at the same time and He can put kings in place and take them out. So we came up with quite a list of things that God could put on His resume of work experience and skill sets. But we also noted that as helpful as all that might be, it really doesn't tell us what God is passionate about. Most of us, when we started dating someone or looked at a long-term friendship, we didn't ask someone what their resume was. We didn't have them submit that to us. We wanted to discover, what do they love? What are they passionate about? What is it that moves their soul to do things? Because that is an important factor in terms of how we relate to others and what we value in others. So we finished that, and then we spent some time looking at the statement by Henry Scougal, a couple hundred years ago, Scottish pastor who made the statement that the worth and excellency of a soul is to be measured by the object of its love. Try and put that in plainer English. The worth, the value, the disposition of a person is measured by what they set their affections on. That tells you a lot about who a person, not just what they do, because we can do things that don't necessarily align with what our heart loves or delights to, but what we set our affections on really speaks profoundly and deeply about who we are. And if we set our love and affections on wicked, base things, then that says something about the state of our soul. If we set our things on high, noble, praiseworthy, good things, then that says something about the state of our soul. And so we said, finally, that's not only true of us as human beings, but it's also true of God. So that's a premise that we're moving forward with, is that the things that God sets his affections, the things that God delights in, say something about his worth and excellence. And so we're going to try and discover, what are those things that God takes delight in? And then finally, we spent a little bit of time trying to build a bridge and saying there's really two things in life that we're pursuing. If you're a follower of Jesus, if you're a believer, you want to be happy. Everyone wants to be happy. But we also want to glorify God. And sometimes it feels like those things come into tension. But in fact, if it's true that the greatest source of happiness is God himself, then the more we grasp of who God is and the things that he delights in and move toward that, the greater our happiness in God will be, and the more glory God gets as the greatest treasure of the universe, right? So those things that seem like their intention, my happiness and wanting to serve God's glory, actually come together in one pursuit as we seek our joy in God. And then finally, we wrapped up just by looking at, 2 Corinthians 3 and 4 make references to us being transformed into the image of the Lord as we behold the glory of the Lord. So there's something about just looking at, seeing glory that has a transformative effect to the state of my soul. So, using the analogy of taking a picture, getting a clear picture, we said, you know, there are things that allow us to get a clear picture, being in focus, not being distracted, being in the right position, the environment, all those things can impact their ability to take a good picture. And it's also true of our ability to get a clear picture and focus on God, is we need to get focused. We need to see, are there things that are distracting us? Are we in the right place, in the right position, so that we get a clearer picture of God in his greatness and in his excellence? But it's not just us, right? Because we also need the miracle of God showing up and shining into my cold and dark heart so that I can actually see, embrace, appreciate the glory of God. If God doesn't show up and speak the miracle of light into my dark heart, then I won't see it. So it's both us looking to behold the glory of God and God showing up and shining light that makes that happen, so that we actually experience delight in the things that God delights in. So that's what we did last week, and here we are, and we're going to press forward. So this morning, I want us to take a few minutes to explore personality trait preferences as they relate to God. And so in your notes, I've included a list. Go ahead and take that in hand. And what I want to have you do here is try to identify within that list the five most attractive personality traits that you see in that list. Now, I sort of did some internet shopping, and I saw what generally comes to the top. I'll share that with you in a minute. But go ahead, take a minute, identify five of those in the list that you think would be, these are the most attractive personality traits. Like if I was going to be in a long-term relationship with someone, whether considering being married to them or a best friend, these are the five that I would really want to be part of their personality makeup. So go ahead and identify those. I'll give you just a minute to do that, and then I'll come back and get your response. And then of those five, see if you can identify one that kind of rises to the top. Like, this would be the one I really want. Okay? So go ahead, do that. Get your notes. If you don't have notes, grab some in the back. This would be a good time to do that. And I'll talk to you in just a minute about what your thoughts are. All right, don't overthink it. This won't go on your heavenly report card. So let's just sort of get a take. I'll go through the list and see how many of these particular ones came into your top five list, and then I'll find out what the top one came through. So approachable, anybody get that in their top five? Okay, a few of you determined? No? Okay, good listener? Yeah. Independent? Optimistic? Cheerful? Okay, good. We've got some people like cheerful, fair-minded, fair, happy. Are you laughing that only one person wanted someone to be happy? We'll come back to that. Intelligent. Okay, there's a few of you who want to have intelligent friends. Passionate. Okay. Sensitive. Good. Compassionate. Okay, yeah, a lot more. Friendly. Nobody wants friendly. Honest. Okay, a few more of you there. Pure. Good. Spiritual. Did I skip one? Kind. Yeah, I did. Okay, kind. Good. Sorry, thanks. Pure spiritual. Anybody get spiritual on the list? Confident. Okay. Good humored. Humble. Okay. Open minded. Responsible. Trustworthy. Okay. Well, I suppose there are a few. Well, let me just get a few responses. What did you put as your top one? Anybody willing to share? Like, what was your top one? Like, trustworthy. Okay, good. Anyone else? Pure?
Spiritual.
Spiritual. Okay.
Compassionate.
Compassionate?
Passionate.
Gracious. Gracious. Okay. Was that on my list?
No.
You cheated. Anyone else?
Humble.
Humble. Kind. Okay, good. Well, here are, I suppose, depending on what studies come up in your Google searches or whatnot, you could probably come up with a few different lists. But there was a constellation of a number that typically made the top five in a lot of the lists I looked at. Intelligent was one. It ranks lower in our group for some reason. I'm not sure why. I won't comment on that. But confident is another one. Trustworthy is another one. The top two were, interestingly enough, kind and good-humored. Survey says, there you go, take it for what it's worth. With that, here's the question I really want to ask, though. With regard to God, if you were going to say, this is the most attractive personality trait of God or that I'd like to see in God, would your list change? Or would it be the same? Someone said it would not change. Anyone think they would change those answers? Maybe?
Shift one, I think, at least. I haven't thought through the other four, but I press shift to approachable, because that aspect of my relationship with God.
Okay. So when it comes to God, we would put potentially a higher premium on the fact that we want God to be approachable. Okay. Good comment. Anyone else have thoughts in that regard? Yeah, Gary?
Somebody cheated and said that grace, our whole spiritual life is based on grace.
Okay. So we might not put gracious in, at least one of us did, but not all of us put that in our relationship with other people. But when it comes to God, we want a gracious God, right? Okay. Okay. Good. Yeah.
Why wouldn't, I guess I confuse the word spiritual because it seems like to me spiritual includes those other things.
Okay. So the comment is, why wouldn't we say spiritual? Because spiritual kind of includes some of the other things that we're talking about. Yeah, okay. Yeah, Dan.
I think when you deal with words, the ones that I chose were ones that I thought incorporated some of the other ones. For instance, spiritual is pure and kind and honest and humble, all fit into. If you're
okay.
Spiritual,
yeah.
You'll have those.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so some of the words Dan's saying encompass more of the other words more readily, and so he was making his choices like, how can I get the biggest bang for my buck by getting the catch-all terms that get everything else in there? Okay, well let's move on, and let's spend a couple of minutes looking at this phrase that we find in 1 Timothy 1:11. Paul refers to the gospel of the glory of the blessed God to which he's been entrusted. And so I want you to think, how would you translate, how would you put that phrase in your own words?
Like the good news of the glory of the blessed God.
Okay, so good. So it's often good to look at gospel and remember gospel would be more transparently translated good news. Okay, so something good news. Good. What is the good news? The good news. Well, okay. So gospel is good news, but what is that news? What's the content of the good news? Thank you. What's that?
Advent of Christ.
Well, there's no the word Christ is not in there. So in this verse, we're trying to say what is Paul talking about? Yeah, Chris.
Well, God tells us in 1 Timothy 2 that his desire is for everyone to be saved and know the truth, and the gospel is how we carry out his desire.
Okay. All right. So the comment is that we know from 1 Timothy 2 that God's desire is that all would be saved, and so the gospel would carry this out. But let's try and focus on this verse. What is being said about the gospel in this verse? Yeah.
I said the good news is about the true story of God's declared glory to bring us back to himself.
That's good. Here's how John Piper translates it in his book, The Pleasures of God. The good news of the glory of the happy God. So blessed is this term. We use it a lot. What does it really mean? Blessed are the pure in heart. Blessed are those who mourn, right? So it really, it's a term that means happy or fortunate in a good state. When you take that phrase then, what's being said is the good news is that the glory of God consists in him being happy. Okay? The good news in this context is that God is a happy God, and that's glorious. Have you thought of the gospel in those terms before? Paul uses that. He actually uses that reference to the happy God or the blessed God twice in 1 Timothy. The other one is in chapter 6, verse 15. So just keep that in mind, that in Paul's view, an integral part of the good news is that the glory of God consists in him being a happy God. The good news of the glory, the worth, the excellence of the happy God. All right, so keep that in your purview, and then let's look at a few other verses. So, and with these verses, I want you to be asking the question, what do they anticipate that believers will share in, and what does that indicate about God's personality? Okay? So, Matthew 25, 23, so we're asking two questions. What is anticipated that believers will share in, and what does that say about God and his personality? First, reference is Matthew 25, 23. His master said to him, "Well done, good and faithful servant." So this is within the context of the parable of the talents, right? So they all get varying talents and they invest them differently. And so this is one of the servants that invested well. And he says, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master." John 15, 11. "These things I have spoken to you," Jesus is talking to his disciples, "that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be full." And then in his high priestly prayer, John 17, 13, "But now I am coming to you, and these things I speak in the world that they may have my joy fulfilled in themselves." So with those verses in view, what do they anticipate we will share in, and what does that say about God?
God's joy, if he wants to.
Okay, all right, good. So we're invited to share in the joy of our master. That's clearly a reference to God. So the expectation is that we're being invited to share in something that the master has, namely joy, right? And Jesus focuses that more explicitly on himself when he says that my intention is, my reason for sharing these things with you is that my joy would be in you and your joy would be full, right? So what does that say about God? What kind of a God are we talking about? A happy camper. Does God like to go camping? Thank you, Dan. Yeah. So we have phrases that talk about the gospel of the glory of the happy God, and we have invitations to enter into the joy of God as one of the great things that's anticipated in store for our futures. So why is it good news that God is a happy God? Why is that good news?
Better than him being a mad God.
Yeah. Thank you, Kathy. It's better than him being a mad God, right? Nobody wants to spend eternity with a grumpy God, right? Do you?
No.
The reality is that God exists in a state of inexhaustible, unassailable, infatigable joy and happiness. That's our God. And that's the one that you're being invited to spend eternity with, right? Jesus invites us to spend eternity with a happy God. Now, I know there are issues connected to that about what do we do then with all the tragedy and loss and pain and suffering in this world, and we'll probably get into that some, but just know that even with all of that, it doesn't exhaust or eclipse or supersede the fact that God is, in all his fullness, a happy, joyful God. Kathy.
That this whole 2:4, these verses indicate that God is ... There's a real danger, I think, from reading those, that the answer to that would be, God is happy when I am happy. And that's a really lousy gospel.
Okay, so the comment is there's a danger that we could frame this saying that God is happy when I am happy. And so what's the danger there?
Well, then it's about us.
Okay, so the danger is that it all becomes about us, that God's happiness is somehow tied to whether or not I am happy. I would say that God is happy when we are happy in Him. It gives Him delight because our happiness in God actually points to the fact that He is a great and awesome God. Whereas if we're just kind of putting up with God or so-so with God, that doesn't say much about God. But it can be reversed so that God is all about making me happy just for the sake of my happiness without reference to God Himself. And if we were sort of taken out of the question, then God would have a deficiency or a deficit. Like God wouldn't be as happy if I wasn't happy, which is not what I'm saying. So yeah, thanks for the comment. All right, well, let's move on and identify some of the major aspects of God's foremost delight in His Son. And what I want to do to sort of get thinking along these lines is encourage you to, as much as you can, in small group three or four, take just a couple minutes to answer this question. Why do we, the things rather that we enjoy, fail to sustain our undiminished pleasure in them over time? Okay, so you enjoy things in life. I don't know what they are. I know some of them are, but the question is, why do those things fail to sustain our undiminished time, joy, and pleasure in them over time? Okay, so talk about that. I want you to come up with some reasons. Why do you think we just cease being satisfied in things over time? Is that clear? Some? Okay. Well, let's try. Get in a group. Ask your group to help you if I wasn't clear. But let's just try and think, what is it that causes us to not have joy in things? You got me? Okay, let's see if we can get some feedback from you. Why do the things we enjoy fail to sustain our full pleasure in them over time? What do you think?
God set everything up with diminishing value.
Because God set everything up with diminishing value, okay?
Oh, that's interesting.
We mature, we change.
We mature and we change. And so does that mean that as we mature, we have less ability to enjoy something?
I'm not talking about things of God. I'm talking about things of this world.
Yeah.
So is that what you're focusing on?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, primarily things in this world. So what are your thoughts? Any other, Cal?
We said basically that just the repetition of enjoying something, like Rand pointed out, candies. Candy is good, but candy forever, candy is a lot less good. It's just the novelty kind of wears off.
Okay, yeah. So you eat that first candy bar, it's good, but that 10th candy bar in a row, it stops tasting quite so good, huh? Yeah. I can tell you about Snickers candy bars in Tajikistan when we had first 2 years we lived there, and I had stomach issues, and I found that if I ate a delicious Snickers candy bar, it was great. It did amazing things. But after about 3 months of eating Snickers candy bars, they lost their pleasure for me, let me tell you. they did their medicine, but they weren't very pleasurable. What else? Any other thoughts? Why do things that we enjoy fail to sustain our delight in them? Yeah, I'll come back to you.
I think we kind of look for pleasure to fulfill some kind of need that we have. Obviously, we're looking for something because we have needs.
Okay, so we have needs, and so somehow those things don't meet those needs.
And they don't meet those needs.
Okay, good. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Over here?
It becomes boring, stale, redundant.
It becomes boring, stale, redundant, repetitive. Okay, good. Any other inputs? Yeah, Candy.
Sometimes we physically can't enjoy some of the things we used to.
Good point. So sometimes we physically can't enjoy things that we used to. I love to play full-on tackle football in high school. Guess what? Ain't happening. Any other thoughts? Yeah.
So perhaps God not only designed the things in this world to fall apart, but he designed in us to not have sustainable pleasure in anything but him. So all the things we look to fail over time because he's pushing us to take pleasure in him.
Okay. So the comment is maybe God actually designed us to not be satisfied or have our pleasure in things in this world designed because that would push us to take our delight and pleasure more in him. Yeah.
Well, some of the material things that we desire here on earth, especially when we're young and we get those things, they just they get old and they start turning into a lot of work and a lot of money.
So some of the things that we really think we want when we're young turn into things that end up costing a lot of time and money when we're older. And so the maintenance of those things takes away some of the joy. Those are good thoughts. Let me just put on the board three things that John says that he tries to summarize what they are. One is, he says, nothing in this world lacks the personal worth that will meet our deepest longings, right? So there's nothing that's just big enough to really fill that longing in our hearts for what is excellent and amazing and pleasing. Secondly, he says, and some of you guys have noted this, we lack the capacity to enjoy those things that might be really enjoyable if we could, you know? And some of that is just, you know, we know that as we grow old, we can't maybe go out and hike the mountains or play the same sports or do some of the things that we used to be able to do. But even when we're younger, we are limited in the things that we can see and the places we can go and our ability to understand things and therefore pick up on all of the delight of their splendor. So we are limited just in our capacity to be able to see those things. And then finally, as has been noted, nothing lasts, right? All of the greatest, even if they're good things, they don't last. Even the most permanent things that we may look to, ultimately, over time, are going to erode, break down, or die. So nothing lasts. And so because of those three reasons, and we might hang a few more things on there, say it slightly differently, but the reality is, if you are pinning your desire to be happy ultimately on anything in this world, you are going to find your pleasure in those things diminished over time. Now, we'll get to this as we move through the class. That doesn't mean you shouldn't take any delight or pleasure in the things that are in this world. But how you take delight and pleasure in them is really, really important. So hold on, we'll get to more of that. But let's ask the question then, what would be needed to change that status of affairs? We're affirming or asserting that nothing in this world is going to sustain our undiminished pleasure. So as you look at these three things, what would need to change for us to have sustained, undiminished pleasure? Yeah. Okay, we need God's desires to become our desires. Did I see another hand over here, Rex? Our hearts? Okay, so what you guys are saying is our desires would need to change to what? To actually delight in the things that God delights in? Okay. Any other thoughts? Yeah? A new world? Right? One maybe that doesn't break down and diminish, or okay?
Well, I think it's the object of what we're looking for, right? It needs to be eternal, nothing less. And we need to be born again so we get the capacity to savor the best treasure. And then nothing, it's got to meet our deepest longings.
Yeah, great, okay. That's great. I think Kaya read the book. So basically what she's saying is, if we are going to experience undiminished joy, then the thing we set our affections on has to be big enough to meet our undiminished capacity or desire for pleasure. We need something to happen in our state of existence that would allow us to continue to look on and enjoy that. So something needs to change with my body, spiritual state, right? And then whatever that object is that we've set our affections on would need to be something that over time doesn't get old and decay and go away, right? What fits that bill?
God.
And more specifically, the manifestation of God in the person of the Son, Jesus Christ, right? So with that in mind then, let's look at a couple of passages out of Matthew. Matthew 12 and Matthew 17. I'm just going to read through these. They're in your notes. And I want you to try and think, what is unique about the way the Son is portrayed in these passages that the Father takes delight in, okay? So Matthew 12, 18, 21. So Jesus, aware of this, he withdrew from there, and many followed him, and he healed them all, and he ordered them not to make him known. This was to fulfill what was spoken of by the prophet Isaiah. Behold, my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved with whom my soul is well pleased. I will put my spirit upon him, and he will proclaim justice to the Gentiles. He will not quarrel or cry aloud, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, a smoldering wick he will not quench, until he brings justice to victory, and in his name the Gentiles will hope. So hold that on one side for a second. Let's look at the other one. Matthew 17, this is on the Mount of Transfiguration, as it's often referred to. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John, his brother, and he led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun. And his clothes became white as light. And behold, there appeared to them Moses and Elijah talking with him. And we'll skip down. When he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." And when the disciples heard this, they fell on their faces and were terrified. You better believe it. So, two different portraits of the Son that explicitly are said that God takes delight in. So what's the contrast? What do you see in those two passages that mark out what God takes delight in the Son? Yeah.
It seems like the quote from Isaiah emphasizes his humility, and just, I guess that would be it. And the other one emphasizes the glory that he has.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so one emphasizes the humility of the Son, the other emphasizes the glory of the Son. Anyone want to add to that or flesh that out a little bit? Yeah?
Well, Jesus is the exact representation of God, so if we look at Jesus, we know what we're supposed to be.
Okay, so Jesus is the exact representation of God, so if we look at Jesus, we know what we're supposed to be. Is that what you said? Yeah? Okay. Any other thoughts? Yeah?
Chapter 12 passage, God talks about Jesus, how he is his servant.
Mm-hmm.
So Jesus is willing to do the Father's will, even though he's equal.
Yeah. I'll repeat that. Sorry, I'm trying to repeat all the comments. So his comment was that in Matthew chapter 12, the focus is on specifically Jesus being the servant of God. Even though he was equal with God here, the Father takes delight in the fact that he is functioning in a servant role. Anything else?
It's obedience, his character.
Obedience? So there's in Matthew 12, there's this obedience of Jesus doing the Father's will. So there's a sermon that Jonathan Edwards wrote. It's a really long sermon, so it would be more like a seminar for our context. And its title is The Excellency of Christ. It's based on Revelations 5, verses 5 and 6, where John is weeping because there's no one found worthy to open the scrolls of the coming judgments of God. And then one of the elders says to John, "Weep no more. Behold, the Lion, the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and seven seals." So that's what the elder says, "Behold." And he turns and he looks, and what's he see? A lion? A lamb. As though it had been slaughtered. And so Jonathan Edwards writes a sermon on the excellencies of Christ, of these two, the lion and lamb, coming together in one person. And so he notes these contrasting aspects that reside in the person of Christ. I'll just go through them. Infinite highness and infinite condescension. Infinite justice and infinite grace. Infinite glory and lowest humility. Infinite majesty and transcendent meekness. Deepest reverence toward God and equality with God. Infinite worthiness of good and the greatest patience under the suffering of evil. An exceeding spirit of obedience and supreme dominion over heaven and earth. Absolute sovereignty and perfect resignation. Self-sufficiency and the entire trust and reliance on God. And so Edwards sums it up by this. He says, "There do meet in the person of Christ such really diverse excellencies which otherwise would have been thought utterly incompatible in the same subject, such as are conjoined in no other person whatever, either divine or human or angelical, and such as neither men nor angels would ever have imagined could have met together in the same person had it not been seen in the person of Christ." So there we have an amazing picture of Christ being this unimaginable bringing together of these excellent characteristics of one who is sovereign, all-powerful, just, and yet gracious, condescending, humble. And these are the excellencies of Christ. Gonna just quickly look at a couple of things. If you guys are anxious about the fact that we're not far enough along in your notes, don't be anxious about that. We'll just stop and I'll pick up the rest next week. But some other passages that are noteworthy with regard to highlighting the affection and love that the Father has for the Son. Let's just look at a couple of those. John 1:18, "No one has ever seen God, only the only God who is at the Father's side, he has made him known." John 3:34 and 35, "For he whom God sent utters the words of God, for he gives the Spirit without measure. The Father loves the Son and has given all things into his hand." John 5:20, "The Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself is doing, and greater works than these he will show him, so that you may marvel." John 10:17, "For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I may take it up again." John 17:5. Now, Father, glorify me in your presence with the glory that I had with you before the world existed. Finally, he prays, Father, I desire that they also whom you have given me may be with me where I am to see my glory that you have given me because you have loved me before the foundation of the world. Jesus is unique in his position and relation to the Father. At his side, all things revealed to him, all things put into his hand. Father delights in the fact that the Son lays his life down only to take it up again. You know, there is no comparable thing in the universe that the Father sets his affections on compared to the Son. So I'll go one step into section 4, and then we'll pick up the rest later. So here's an important implication of what we've been looking at. In Colossians, Paul writes twice about the Son. The beloved Son is the reference in verse 13. He says, for in him, that is in Jesus, all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. Again in chapter 2, verse 9, for in him the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily. And so the conclusion from that and many other verses, I believe I have this in your notes, is that the Bible teaches that the eternal God has always had a perfect image, a perfect radiance, a perfect stamp or imprint of his nature, and a perfect form or expression of his glory. Now think about that. Jesus is the perfect image, the perfect radiance, the essence of who God himself is. When God looks at the Son, what is he seeing? He's seeing himself. And so we may conclude that the pleasure God has in his Son is pleasure in himself, in the fullness of who he is for all eternity. Before the world existed, God had fullness of delight in the sheer reality of his existence, reflected in the person of the Son forever, undiminished, without beginning and without end. That is our God. Now, we might think of that as being vanity if we're the ones that are taking delight in ourselves, right? But it's not vanity for God, because God is the most worthy thing in the universe, the most excellent thing in the universe, right? If God were to set his affections on something other than that, he'd be an idolater. He would love something of lesser value if he set his affections on anything other than himself. And here's the great thing, is that God also invites us into the enjoyment of the fullness of who he is for all eternity. That is at the heart of the gospel. God's delight in being God and who he is, and his joy in that, is not vanity. It is the foundation of the gospel. It is what you're being invited into as the outcome of the gospel. So let me stop there. There's a problem that arises from that fact, that God takes highest supreme delight in his Son as a reflection of who he is. That creates a problem for us, so I want to talk about that next week. And then I want to talk about how it's also the Son that becomes then the solution to that. So I think that will be good for us. But let me pray for us, and we'll be done. Father, a mere hour is surely not enough to scratch the surface of the excellencies of your Son that have been true and real for all of eternity. But I pray that by your sovereign hand and pleasure, you would be working in us to open up our hearts with greater capacity to experience delight and amazement, to be in awe of your Son. For your glory and our undiminished joy, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, y'all, that's all for this installment. We'll see you next week. Week 3, we'll finish this up, and then we'll be looking at God's delight in His glory.